Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would
bias. A journalist used to cover more bias.
It's Wednesday, October 5th, 2011, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here at the table with me are regular panelists and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. A group made up largely of young people has been protesting near Wall Street for a couple of weeks now. Have the news media told us what we need to know about who they are and what they want? A Christian minister has been sentenced to death in Iran for heresy against Islam, or is it for rape and sedition? And why is this story getting relatively little coverage so far? NPR's new boss is coming from Sesame Street. Can he depoliticize the network? And can he continue NPR's new media thrust while also placating local affiliates? And the newspaper in Iowa City, Iowa, is getting heat from its readers for what some feel is just a bit too much transparency. I'm happy to say that three of today's topics came directly from our audience, and the first one involves the so-called Occupy Wall Street protests that are going on in New York. Charles, one of your students was wondering out loud the other day why the mainstream media, from his perspective at least, are providing relatively little coverage of so far. What do you think about that?
Yeah, although it's kind of timely because after the student came up and mentioned it, I had heard about it through social networks and through email, but I hadn't seen any news media coverage. So I thought, wow, that's an interesting point. So I went back and did a little Googling around, and she was largely right. I mean, there was media coverage, but wow, was it muted. It was sort of one-off stuff, right? We linked to this Christian Science Monitor sort of media apologia today, in which they say, but there was coverage. There was one story on ABC and Fox did a little bit. Oh, yeah, Fox did a bit, all right. But the general mainstream non-trashing coverage, I guess I would call it, came this week. So it's kind of timely. There's been a lot of coverage the first three or four days of this week.
Yeah, it seemed to me, Lee, like it was maybe just a little slow ramping up. I don't know, maybe because there were things like, I don't know, Conrad Murray or Amanda Knox or the whole thing over Chris Christie, other stories that were kind of keeping the media from picking up steam on this one quite as quickly as they should have.
I think there's that. But one of the things that we know academically is that the media are terrible about covering social movements. We were terrible about the civil rights movement. We were terrible about the women's rights movement. We've not been so bad about the Tea Party because I think it has a political in addition to a social edge. I think it's too soon to know whether this is a, quote, social movement in the sense of civil rights or women's rights, but it certainly has aspects like that to it. I think the other thing that's going on here, and I'm going to say some pejorative stuff about New York folks, is that the initial day when there were like seven protesters, and then the next day there were like a dozen, and then the next day there were like 200. In New York, that's a story worth ignoring because there are seven of almost anything doing almost everything at any given time in every 24-hour cycle. What the problem with all of that is that this protest is, in my view, some counter speech to a lot of what is going on in Washington. And I think it's taken us too long to pick up on that particular part of the frame.
I wonder if the slowness also had a little bit to do, Charles, with just the way that we are comfortable in the media covering these kinds of stories. Well, when they were marching across the bridge and the cops got involved, okay, we know how to tell that story. When Susan Sarandon or Michael Moore shows up and there's a celebrity involved, we know how to cover that story. We don't really know how to cover the movement, as Lee was talking
about.
Yes,
and there was no, you know, scripted list of demands. The whole thing was not being bankrolled by some financier. And covered, you know, 24/7 on a cable network channel like the Tea Parties was. I was tickled by that Christian Science Monitor thing in which our friend Tom Rosensteel from the Center for Excellence in Journalism says something along the lines of, this was more coverage than the Tea Party got the first day. And I'm like, Really? Because Fox News devoted a 12-hour block to that, as I recall. So it didn't have that sort of formal media planning presence around it. And I don't even want to use the analogy to the Tea Party, because this is different. This is an inchoate, unorganized social movement that is occurring organically and emerging really ground up. I mean, you talk about grassroots as opposed to AstroTurf. Here's a great distinction between two different movements.
The other thing about it is it in many ways, although it's not being framed this way sometimes even by the protesters, this is all about public policy. This is about how have we as a country responded to what went on in Wall Street as long as 2 and now maybe 3 years ago, as well as what's going on right up to current day. And it's one of those, for me, interesting places where we're sort of watching the government, the formal people in power, catch up to where the populace, I think, in many ways is.
I guess I wouldn't be quite as critical as Charles was of Tom Rosenstiel and the folks at the Project for Excellence in Journalism, because sometimes they have data to back up or to not back up some of our basic assumptions. And I do think it's pretty interesting that they say in the first week of coverage, about 12% of all the economic stories that were in the media, which is about 2%, not a lot, but 2% of the total news whole, was devoted to these folks. And that's more than occurred with the Tea Party in the first week of the Tea Party's existence. We'll see how that coverage goes on. But I must say, though, I was struck a little bit by how the political agenda of some of the big news organizations on this particular story were just so transparent in the way that they framed the coverage. Here, for example, we're going to show you how Fox News legal analyst Peter Johnson cast the protesters the other day on Fox and Friends.
These folks are deluded in a lot of ways and probably provide the best argument for national service for 18-year-olds that we have ever seen in this country. And so we have the likes of Michael Moore and Susan Sarandon and Princeton Professor Cornell West, all assumedly millionaires, who are speaking out against capitalist greed, against Wall Street, against the government, and against our ability to create jobs and stop the foreclosure of homes.
On the other hand, you had the New York Times giving more sympathetic, but still, I thought, rather patronizing reports in some instances about the youthful demonstrators. On the Times website, for example, columnist Nicholas Kristof spelled out more concrete and focused ways that he thought that they could get their message across to the wider public.
So as the Wall Street protests gain traction, and as they bubble up around the country, I offer these suggestions to those protesters as a way of translating their amorphous frustration into a tangible program of changes that might make our financial system more accountable and more equitable.
So, Charles, did you sense any sort of condescension toward these young people because they were young people in the coverage?
Oh, sure, openly. I mean, one of the things, I think Lee hit the nail on the head, social change leaves the mass media sort of off balance. They don't really know how to cover it because it is, by its very nature, organic and slow-moving and cumulative. It also, in many cases, I think, challenges many of the assumptions, the sort of archetypes that have always fueled a lot of coverage. And so when you have people taking on things as fundamental as the monetary policy-making arm of the United States government, the sort of status quo bias of the larger mass media really kicks in. And then you throw in ageism, which here is massive. I saw somebody today on television say, well, how can this many people be here day after day after day? Just take a peek at the unemployment numbers from 18 to 25 in this country, and you'll notice that fully a third of those people are utterly unemployed. So indeed, yes, they can go spend a couple of weeks in Central Park. They've got nothing else to do, or in Wall Street.
As a member of the generation that spent a fair amount of time on the streets in the late 1960s and early 70s, this is so familiar because it's how the mainstream media treated the Vietnam protesters. I also spent some time last night, some very enjoyable hours, watching Ken Burns' documentary about Prohibition, which has some, well, first off, it's a wonderful piece of work. But within that, it had some remarkable things to say about the economy and the relationship between economics and, in this case, Prohibition. But I sort of drew the larger thing about the relationship between economics and government policy over money generation. You know what? There there were these kinds of protests over prohibition in the early 1930s. So I saw real parallels here. And the thing I liked about Burns's work, of course, it has the virtue of history, but there's no condescension there at all.
I want to talk just a little bit, too, about this article Charles mentioned from the Christian Science Monitor, trying to explain or at least get some experts to talk about why the media was performing the way they did. And they talked about, and I thought, you know, rightly so, about this sort of middle class movement of middle class kids who can't find middle class employment anymore. But there were a couple of other things that I thought were kind of interesting, one being the notion that where's the charismatic, quotable leader? And if they have somebody like that, they'll get better media attention. Charles, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Sense to you?
Well, I mean, I highly recommend this article. It's a literal trope of things going wrong with our news media, all condensed into one piece. One, we need an eloquent spokesperson so that they can talk to us so that we can figure out what the story is. Two, and they flat out say this in the piece. This story is really complex. It's hard, and we don't want to do it because it's so difficult. Can you just distill it down to some guy, you know, in a three-cornered hat playing a flute? We like that sort of symbolism. I thought it was telling.
It looks to me, too, Lee, like as with a lot of stories these days, the social media are really going to be driving the legacy media's coverage. It's all happening in social media first.
It's happening. The notice of the demonstrations is happening in social media first. The understanding of what the demonstrations are about, the potential political and social legs that those demonstrations might have, I don't expect to see that in social media. I'm not confident that I'll see it in mainstream media, but I appreciate the Christian Science Monitor story, and then basically what I want to do is give it an F and say, I've got students here at the Missouri School of Journalism who can do this work if given the time and the encouragement. Don't tell me we as a profession can't do this.
Let's take a look at another undercovered story. This is our second topic, and it comes from one of our listeners as well, this time from Ann Barker, who's a humanities librarian over on the MU campus. And the story involves an Iranian Christian minister. His name is Yousef Nadarkhani, and he was accused of apostasy, essentially being born in a Muslim country and yet not standing for Islam, and therefore he was given the death penalty because he would not renounce his Christian roots or what he had talked about. Now, there's been some talk in the blogosphere, mostly among religious journalists and other people, about his case, but very little coverage until the past few days in the so-called mainstream media. And now that the mainstream media have spent a little bit of time covering the story, we see the Iranian government now coming out and claiming, oh, no, it wasn't about apostasy. It wasn't about religious freedom. He's accused of rape and extortion and threatening the state. I just wonder, and I think the numbers bear out the lack of media coverage on this so far. I was just doing some counting and looking at the websites. CNN and Fox have done a pretty decent job on the television side of covering it. Some of the print media have done a pretty good job, too. But most of the other television networks are relying on wire service accounts and very darn few of those so far. Why would that be, Charles?
Oh, I guess twofold. I think, one, there's an economic lens here. Qualified, really deep expert staff religion writers are rare these days. There's just not a lot of people out there on the beat. There are a lot of freelance people. There are a lot of book authors. There are tremendous experts around religion journalism. Many of them aren't employed by dailies anymore, so you can't look for a lot of that out of the dailies. When things emanate from the highly ideological press, either left or right, and I think this is the second factor and maybe an even bigger one, back in mainstream media land, I think people see those sorts of things emanate from really far right blogs, really left blogs, and they kind of take them with a huge grain of salt. They don't know if the facts undergirding them are even remotely close to right. That said, that's no excuse, right? I mean, this is a legitimate global human rights story. Great amount of attention needs to be played on this story so that Iran feels the pressure of the world, not just the United States. And so I offer those up, I guess, as excuses, not rationalizations.
Yeah, Lee, I was taken by the fact that our listener from the libraries who was following this story was very frustrated, as were several religion writers out there in the blogosphere, who were saying this shouldn't be cast as a left or right, you know, wing right. ideology story. This is a story that the media should focus on because we pay darn little attention to religion news anyway, and then we look for excuses not to cover it when it comes around and hits us over the head.
I want to add one more thing to what Charles said, which is we don't have a readily quotable source on this. We can't reach the minister, at least as I'm understanding. We certainly can't put him on camera or get him on the air in that way. And so it's a story that we're essentially getting second or third hand, which I think makes journalists, regardless of beat, very nervous. It's kind of like, what else are we missing? At the same time, I do first want to thank the librarian for bringing this to our attention, because until she had, I didn't know a thing about it.
No,
so thank you for at least informing me. I also think that this is a place where, as we're trying to learn how to live in a world that has many faiths, we as journalists are trying to figure out, how do you report on something that seems like it's one kind of issue to us, religious freedom. Okay, that's easy. Americans like to cast a lot of things in religious freedom rights. But to other folks, may look as an assault on their religion, an assault on a state which is essentially portraying itself as, among other things, a theocracy. And so this is too a complicated story and a difficult one for us to sort of wrap our brains around, if you will.
But I also wonder if this isn't a lot like the previous story we were talking about, in that the media have these very simplistic frames or lenses in which they look at them. Okay, when President Obama issues a statement through his spokesman at the White House, or when Hillary Clinton issues a statement, okay, we understand how to cover that story. When the Iranian government says, no, it was rape, or is there some political, you know, involvement in the story, we understand how to cover that. But we don't want to get down and cover the underlying issues of religiosity, except when they have some sort of a political context.
Well, and here you can get past the religiosity fairly easy by just embracing human rights. Yeah. I mean, if you face execution for what you believe, and I don't care what it is you believe, then we've got a massive human rights issue, and I don't care where you are. So I don't know. I mean, I think this is a story that is bipartisan in its very core. It's a human rights story that transcends politics. And I think what we'll see now is a big spotlight beginning to go around this, because it is working its way all over the social networks now.
I agree with Charles in my penultimate analysis of this, but in fact, for many people, it's not a human rights story. It's a story about what the role of religion has in public and private life, when the religion that you're subscribing to, and I don't care what it is, does not allow for certain kinds of dissent, including religious dissent. So it's very American of us to say it's a human rights story. Like I said, Charles, I agree with you. For me, it is as well. But I don't think from the Iranian point of view, from the Islamic point of view, it looks that way very much at all. And I think that's troubling for us, because we don't know how to get it in any other focus.
I'd like to agree also, Charles, with you, that I think even more so than with the protest story, this story is only getting attention from the legacy media because the social media brought it forward first.
And absolutely.
That's too bad, but that's the way it's going to be for a lot of these kinds of stories. All right, let's shift focus a little bit more of sort of insider baseball involving National Public Radio, or NPR now. They don't actually call themselves National Public Radio anymore because they're a full-fledged multimedia company. But they replaced their president. Announced after a big search, after Vivian Schiller had been forced out because of the Juan Williams firing and other, you know, political issues. They've announced that they're hiring the guy who's in charge of Sesame Workshop, the people that produce Sesame Street, both for American public television and for television around the world. And Gary Nell, the new guy, is going to start on December 1st after I think he's got a daughter who's in high school who's waiting to finish up. Then he's going to move from New York down to Washington and take over. And, of course, people are very interested to see how he is going to change or not change the workings of NPR. And I don't know if it's all for public consumption or not, Lee, but one of the first things he said was that he wanted to depoliticize NPR. Well, how does he go about doing that exactly?
Well, I think he needs to go everywhere in a Big Bird suit. Okay, that's my last comment. I actually am a huge fan of Sesame Street, not just for children, but because of the research they've done that has gone into that program. I heard an interview with him on NPR with, I think it was with David Folkenflik. And one of the things he said was that in the process of depoliticizing NPR, he wanted to keep his hands off of NPR journalism. Now, that may not sit well with a lot of people in Congress, but I think with some elements in the country, that will sit extremely well because he doesn't intend to interfere with it from, if you will, a management perspective. I also think because Sesame Street has been, among many other things, a commercial success, that there are folks in the NPR stable, if you will, who are going to say, what kind of new ideas can he bring to this that are going to help us get a different kind of footing that will sustain us financially? And I'm deliberately not using the words commercial because I don't think that it's ever going to be a money-making enterprise in the same way that the traditional legacy media have or recently have not been.
It seems to me, Charles, that the NPR board that selected Gary Nell had to really walk this tightrope because they have, on the one hand, some folks who think that, oh, they weren't seeking somebody who was a strong enough leader, that they played it safe by going after Nell. Who's going to attack the guy who ran Sesame Street when they need, and because of that, in fact, David Folkenflik reported several mainstream media figures, leaders of the media, quote, turned down the opportunity for this job because they didn't want to get involved in all the politics of it. So you got the one side, people thinking, well, it was playing it safe. On the other hand, you've got people that are saying, well, watch out. We don't want to upset the apple cart too much because that relationship between the affiliates and NPR is still a pretty sensitive one.
Yeah. I mean, this story is sort of a tragedy on three levels to me. On the one hand, you have 2% of NPR's budget, which is coming from the federal government. And for that 2%, some members of the Republican Party are willing to fight literally to the death because their symbolic victory, which they wish to claim, is that they got rid of any public funding for news media in this country whatsoever at all, despite, and here's level two of the tragedy, a mountain of evidence that we are much better off with a coexistent commercial and public media system, not a purely private one. As we have moved toward a what? 99% private, 1% public media model? I think most of us who do this stuff for a living conclude that it's been an unmitigated disaster from a fiscal standpoint. And so there's so many tragedies that come out of this. And then the final tragedy is our ability as a nation to take anything and turn it into a partisan issue.
I think, you know, ultimately, though, it may be 100% privately funded before too long. I mean, Vivian Schiller, who was forced out over various issues, actually tweeted, and I thought this was kind of telling, this guy's the perfect guy to move us away from government funding of public media.
Another tragedy.
Well, yeah, it's a tragedy. And at the same time, because of the rancorous, acidic, I'm running out of adjectives, partisan nature of what's going on in Congress right now, taking it out of that particular funding path might be a very good thing for the journalism as well as some of the other programming that happens on NPR. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, people make a lot of fun of this guy about Sesame Street and, you know, the guy who brought us Big Bird. Sesame Street has done more on a lot of social issues than lots and lots of other, I'm going to get in lots of trouble for this, but than a lot of news stories have done. Not just because it's been focused at young people, but because of the way that it's done it. So I'm a little bit more cheered, perhaps, than I should realistically be to have somebody with this kind of sensibility who's going to say, yeah, I'm going to keep the hands off journalism, but that doesn't mean I'm going to keep my hands off the mission. I think the mission is critical.
I guess I'm cheered, but maybe for another reason. I mean, I think this guy's got very good skills at bridging gaps. I mean, I think he understands the sensitive politics of NPR in Washington right now. I think he understands the need for them to move ahead with their digital platforms as a new way of raising money and keeping their journalism sound. But he also has the support of people out in the affiliates. And the affiliates' needs and interests don't always translate into the same interests as those in Washington. So if he can really bridge all those gaps, I think he could be a very good leader to very good time. We'll see how that plays out. Our last story today actually comes from a listener as well, and this is from somebody who doesn't listen to us on the air, but through our podcast on the web. Dan Williamson is from Iowa City, Iowa, the home of the University of Iowa, and he brought to our attention what at first seems like a pretty simple crime story, but maybe not quite so simple. It's short, though, so I'm going to read you most of that story directly from their website, and then we'll talk about it. A Solon, I think it's pronounced Solon, Iowa, maybe it's Solon, I don't know, woman is accused of using a University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics credit card to make personal purchases totaling more than $12,000. It describes her name, etc., and then it says, Sushamel is the wife of Press Citizen sports editor Ryan Sushamel. She was booked at the Johnson County Jail Monday morning on one count of first-degree theft, a Class C felony. She was released on bond. So, what Gary thought, or excuse me, that wasn't the right name, Dan thought was interesting, was the fact that the newspaper felt it necessary to mention the connection to their sports editor when his wife had been accused of, a pretty standard crime. Lee, and some of the readers of the paper were really calling it to task for doing this. Do we really need to go that far as to drag him into a story where he really had nothing to do with it, unquote? What's your feeling about that?
I disagree with Dan, although I appreciate him bringing this one to our attention. The paper was obligated to do this. If they did not do this, a whole bunch of other readers would have accused them of covering up the connection. What becomes telling in an ethical sense, at least for me, is, as far as I'm concerned, this is maybe the only time this needs to get mentioned, unless the spouse is in some way implicated in the actual criminal activity. But if you don't mention it, people will say, oh, you're covering up, you're downplaying it, you've put the story on page 3 instead of on page 1 because a family member of your staff is involved. The only thing you can do at this point is disclose.
This is a lose-loser here, because you get beat up in the comments for doing so. You're going to get roasted in the comments if you don't do so. So there are situations in which there is no good outcome. The question I guess I have, and I'd pose it to our ethicist, at what level do you not disclose? Like, if a kid gets a DUI who's the son of the sports writer, do you disclose that? You know, I mean, do you go in the blotter and look for relatives? At what distance relative, like third cousins, do they not make the cut? This is a wife, this is a spouse, so it's direct.
Yeah, and I think children in one way are easy. If the kid is under 16, no, of course you don't disclose. We wouldn't do that for anybody. Over 16, I think it gets in some way more problematic. But one of the things that journalists have unfortunately learned over the years is that people will, rightly or wrongly, attribute motives to you that have literally nothing to do with what's going on in your head or the decisions that have been made. But we are so public about what we do that disclosure here, I mean, I agree with Charles, it's horrible for the family, but disclosure here is the only remedy.
Well, I mean, it is, but realistically, it's Iowa City, Iowa, a town I love, by the way. I bet about half the people who picked up the paper knew of that connection immediately, right? Because it's a relatively small town.
And I bet there are quite a few more conflicts of interest if we really want to dig very deeply in any smaller town newspaper or media company. Just one really quick thing I want to say. Congratulations to NBC News for doing the right thing. The network is getting rid of, canceling after a few episodes, The Playboy Club, and replacing it in a few weeks with a new news magazine with Brian Williams at the head of it, something that hasn't happened for a long time. Good for them. Well, that's going to have to be it for this week's program. Thanks to Lee and Charles for another engaging discussion. Thanks to our technical team for another good outing. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan, KBIA's Pat Akers, and our new student producer, Ryan Williams. Now, keep those comments coming in via email, views@kbia.org, or you can go to our blog, kbiaviews.blogspot.com, where you can also find links to text, audio, and video related to our topics. I'm Mike McKean. Join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.